Now, on behalf of Harvard Bookstore, I'm very pleased to introduce this afternoon's speakers, here to discuss with liberty and justice for some how the law is used to destroy equality and protect the powerful. A scathing critique of what author Glenn Greenwald calls the two-tiered system of American justice, one that ensures virtual immunity from prosecution for the political and financial class in the U.S. Glenn Greenwald is a former constitutional law and civil rights attorney and is now a columnist, blogger, and author. His books, How Would a Patriot Act?, A Critique of Bush Executive Power Theories, and Tragic Legacy, Documenting the Legacy of Bush, were New York Times bestsellers. He is currently a contributing writer and blogger at Salon.com, where last year he won an online journalism award for his investigative article on the arrest of the alleged leaker to WikiLeaks. Mr. Greenwald has been named one of the most influential liberals in the U.S. media by Forbes and one of America's most influential political pundits by The Atlantic. Of Mr. Greenwald's latest work, With Liberty and Justice for Some, MSNBC's Rachel Maddow recently stated on her show, "I liked it so much, I blurbed it." She praises Mr. Greenwald's, quote, rock-ribbed principles and absolute disregard for partisan favor, which have made U.S. political discourse edgier, more confrontational, and much, much better. Noam Chomsky is known throughout the world for his political and philosophical writings, as well as for his groundbreaking linguistics work. He has taught down the road at MIT since 1955 and remains one of America's most uncompromising voices of dissent. Among Harvard Bookstore's top-selling books of all time, you'll find Chomsky titles, Hegemony or Survival, Understanding Power, On Language, and his book on 9/11, now in its 10th anniversary edition. So with no further delay, allow me to open up this afternoon's discourse. Please join me in welcoming Glenn Greenwald and Professor Noam Chomsky.
So thank you very much. And on behalf of Professor Chomsky, thank you for that very warm reception. Thanks very much for coming this afternoon, and particular thanks to Professor Chomsky. It is indescribably gratifying to be able to write a book and then attend an event to talk about it with the nation's bravest and most accomplished public intellectual and political activist. So I'm particularly grateful to Professor Chomsky for being here. I just want to begin by making a couple of points that I think will frame the discussion that we're going to have nicely, and I'm not sure what that discussion will be because we haven't talked about it on purpose, but there are a couple of points that I anticipate will help to highlight that I think I'd like to just briefly describe. So the book really makes the argument that the rule of law, as we've always understood it, has been radically degraded in a way that wasn't previously true. And the interesting thing about the rule of law is that it's a term that has a pretty clear meaning by consensus. It's not a particularly complex term. It essentially means nothing more than the fact that in a society we are all bound on equal terms by a common set of rules. And you can look to contemporary legal scholars who define it that way. You can look, more interestingly, to the 1980s and the 1990s when Western institutions like the IMF and the World Bank began demanding that lending countries that received lending comported with the rule of law. And there were lots of lectures issued about what they were required to do in order to comport with the rule of law. And there was a seminal journal article by Thomas Carruthers in Foreign Affairs that warned that countries that don't live under the rule of law, in those countries, elites can use their superior financial power to co-opt political institutions. And that the critical requirement to live under the rule of law is that political and financial elites cease placing themselves above the rule of law and are subjected to it on equal terms to everyone else. And you go back to the founders, and as much as disagreement as they had, what you continuously find is this emphasis, not ancillary or secondary, but really central, that the American founding, in order to be legitimate and just, had to venerate the rule of law. And this was true despite the fact that founders, almost across the board, believed in the inevitability and even desirability and virtue of vast levels of inequality in all sorts of realms. And yet they continuously emphasized that the only way that that inequality would be legitimate and just is if everyone were equal before the law. Now, you know, anytime you make the argument or point out that the rule of law and equality before the law was important in the founding, you'll be met with the objection, which is obviously an accurate one as far as it goes, so I don't think it goes very far, that the founders violently breached those principles in all sorts of ways, and that the country did as well, and that this concept of equality under law has never been the predominant theme to describe American political reality. And although that is true, the reason I don't think it goes very far is because the important part of that writing and that history is that that principle has always been affirmed as being central, even at the time that we violated it radically. And the reason that's important is because if you affirm a principle and deviate from it in your actions, there's an obvious aspect to your behavior that is hypocritical. But if the affirmation is sincere and ringing and consistent, then those principles, even though you're not comporting with them, become aspirational. They become guides to what progress means, how it's understood, and how it's achieved. So even though the founders violated that principle in all sorts of ways, the fact that they continuously enshrined it and it was affirmed continuously throughout the next two centuries meant that most of the events that we consider to be progress in American history were driven by the reverence for this concept that we're all equal under the law, that equality under the law is how we determine if we're perfecting the union. And there's a real value in affirming principles even if they're not perfectly applied. And what I think is radically different about today is not that the rule of law suddenly is not being applied faithfully, because that's always been true. What's different about today radically is that we no longer even bother to affirm that principle. We pay lip service to the phrase, the rule of law, but there's, in terms of the substance of what it requires, you can often, and I would say more often than not, in leading opinion-making elite circles, find an express renouncement or repudiation of that principle. So you begin with the Ford pardon of Nixon, continuing through the shielding of Iran-Contra criminals, into the Obama administration's decision to shield all Bush crimes of torture and illegal warrantless eavesdropping, obstruction of justice, the aggressive attack on Iraq, the decision now not to prosecute Wall Street criminals for precipitating the 2008 crisis with systematic financial fraud. All of these acts entail very aggressive and explicit arguments that the most powerful political and financial elites in our society should not be and are not subject to the rule of law because it's too disruptive, it's too divisive, it's more important that we look forward, that we find ways to avoid repeating the problem. And so you really see constant arguments. And you did, for example, during the debate over whether or not the telecom industry should be retroactively immunized for its role in the illegal eavesdropping program, that the rule of law is really not that important of a value any longer. Jerry Ford, when he addressed the nation and tried to convince it to accept the pardon, said, "Of course I believe in the rule of law, the idea that the law is no respecter of persons, but," and this was the amendment that was concocted for that episode, "the law is also a respecter of reality." Meaning that if it's too disruptive or divisive, that it's actually in our common good, not the elite criminals, but in our common good to exempt the most powerful from the consequences of their criminal acts. And that has really become the template used in each of these instances. And that, I think, radically is different than how things were in the past. The other point I want to make, just to begin, then I'll turn the floor over to Professor Chomsky, is that the other difference is that if we had a society that just decided that we were going to be very lenient and forgiving and merciful when people committed crimes, as I just described we do for elites, you could have debates about whether that was an advisable policy or approach to criminality, about whether or not that would be produce good results or not, but if it were applied across the board, at the very least, it wouldn't implicate rule of law issues. There are countries that take very lenient approaches to criminal justice. And if we were a country that applied that same leniency to ordinary Americans as we apply to elites, then there wouldn't be an issue with the rule of law. So, for example, if you went and broke into someone's house and bashed the owner in the head with a baseball bat and stole their valuable belongings, and a week later or 2 months later got caught by the police and you said, "Look, officer, you got me. I did what you think I did, but isn't it more important that we could look to the future? Why focus on the past?" If that were something that worked for you or for people who sold drugs on street corners and the like, then there wouldn't be a rule of law issue. But the fact that that applies only to political and financial elites and not to ordinary Americans is the reason why there's a rule of law problem. At the very same time that we've created this template of elite immunity, we, over the past four decades, we have, in the name of law and order and tough on crime, built the world's largest and most sprawling prison state, one of its harshest and most merciless systems of punishment for ordinary Americans. And the irony that Richard Nixon was the one who received this pardon when, in the 1960s, he rejuvenated his political career by becoming the law and order candidate, following, taking up the mantle of Barry Goldwater, running against the disruption and arrest of the 1960s, demanding harsh sentences, lesser parole, lesser opportunity for release from prison. The drug war was really accelerated first under him. The fact that he built his political career based on this harsh law and order mentality, and then suddenly when he got caught committing crimes was completely shielded from legal consequence, is really the personification of this two-tier justice system that I'm writing about. And then, of course, the war on terror has brought all new tiers of justice where people accused of terrorism, just accused, can have every right deprived from them, including the right to life, without any sort of legal rights or legal process of any kind. It's really a new class, a class where there's not even a pretense of due process. It's a persona non grata, a sub-person class where the government can do anything without any legal constraints at all. And it's this contrast between the shielding and immunity that we've vested in the elite class, or more accurately, that they've vested in themselves, versus the extraordinarily, unprecedentedly harsh and merciless punishment system imposed on everyone else, that is the real menace to the rule of law, and that I think is the most responsible factor for the loss of faith in our political institutions and the widespread accurate belief that you see motivating the Occupy movement and other widespread citizen rage, that our political institutions have lost all remnants of legitimacy and can no longer be used to effectuate change. So I think it's one of the most menacing problems and also one of the most consequential. So.
Well, let me just pick up on Glenn's last comments and say a few things about the rule of law. Happens that last night I was reading the current journal, the current edition of the journal, the main journal of the American Society for Historical Relations, the diplomatic history, and that happens to be devoted to several articles are devoted to the Nuremberg Tribunal and to what it means and how it developed and so on, and the lead article points out that one of the most honorable and admired elements of the American historical tradition, the legal tradition, is the principle of presumption of innocence. That is, a person is presumed innocent, a suspect is presumed innocent until brought to a fair trial and convicted with proper procedural guarantees. That's the proudest achievement of the American legal and ethical tradition. And of course, it was recognized at Nuremberg. The British wanted to just kill the Nazi war criminals, but Justice Jackson, the U.S. Chief Prosecutor, insisted that even though these people are maybe, you know, the worst criminals in history, they should be brought to trial, subjected to a fair trial, condemned if they were proven guilty. And furthermore, he added that we're giving these defendants a poisoned chalice, and if we ever sip from it, meaning if we ever do the things that they're accused of, we must suffer the same consequences, otherwise these proceedings are a complete farce. The core element of the proceedings, the main crime for which the Nazi criminals were condemned and hanged, was what was called in the tribunal the supreme international crime, namely aggression, pretty clearly defined, which they said is, the tribunal said is the worst of all war crimes because it encompasses all the evil that follows. Well, I won't run through the way that's been, we've applied that to ourselves. But that point is correct. Presumption of innocence is a very deeply rooted principle, not of American law, but of Anglo-American law, or it used to be. By now, it's simply totally dismissed, and with praise. So, for example, when Osama bin Laden was the prime suspect for 9/11, plausibly, though in fact, fact of the matter is the government has yet to provide the kind of evidence that would hold up in a credible court, and is even more or less conceded it doesn't have it, but undoubtedly he's the prime suspect. A couple of months ago, Obama invaded another country, commandos apprehended him and murdered him, tossed his body into the ocean without autopsy, and this was praised. This was praised as a great achievement. It's a great achievement of the Obama administration. A couple of months later, the concept was extended in a manner that Glenn talks about in his book, which is a terrific book, I should say. That's the case of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen, a cleric who was accused not of committing, there was some talk about involvement in crimes, but no evidence was presented. The main charge against him was he was a fluent speaker of English, and he was transmitting, he was offering support for jihadi operations. He was killed a couple of weeks ago, and the general reaction was illustrated adequately in a New York Times headline, which said, West celebrates death of radical cleric. Well, it wasn't just death, it was murder, along with another American citizen who happened to be near him. While it's true that the, and there were some who didn't join in the celebration completely, almost all of them criticized it because he was an American citizen, which makes him a person in theory, as distinct from non-citizens who may look like persons but aren't. That's incidentally a core principle of current American law with regard to undocumented aliens, an interesting interpretation of the 14th Amendment. But so he was an actual person, and maybe we're not supposed to murder people suspected of inciting others to carry out terrorist acts. Now, again, there were some critics, and the response who went beyond that and said we should believe in the principle of presumption of innocence. And the reaction to them, actually I was one, was quite interesting. Most of it was the usual shrieking, which you can disregard. But some of it was interesting. And in fact, the most interesting, I thought, was a column by a well-known, respected left liberal commentator, Matthew Iglesias, who wrote that it is, as he put it, amazingly naive to criticize the United States for violation of international law or other crimes, because the international order is established precisely in order to legitimate the use of violence by the West. And by the West, he doesn't mean Norway, he means by the United States. So that's the nature of the international order. It's set up to legitimate our criminal resort to violence, and therefore it's amazingly naive to raise criticisms about this. Incidentally, this is not said in criticism. He's praising it. He goes on to say it's silly even to raise these questions. That happens to be directed to me, and I'm happy to accept guilt for that on that charge. And if you look beyond and ask just what does it mean to be a non-person, say a accused of terrorism, well, there's a striking example in Glenn's book. As he points out, the first child soldier in American history to be brought to trial for crimes, and that one's worth looking at. That's Omer Khadr. He's a 15-year-old boy who was apprehended in Afghanistan, and the charge against him is that when American soldiers were invading Afghanistan and attacking his village, he picked up a gun to defend his village. So that makes him a terrorist, a non-person, and interesting concept of terrorism. He was then first sent to Bagram, secret prison in Afghanistan, then sent off to Guantanamo, 8 years in prison, no charges. After 8 years in prison, he was going to be brought to what's called a trial before a military commission. We'll have to talk about that. But he pleaded guilty and a plea bargain and was given an 8-year sentence in addition to the 8 years he spent without charges. We all know what it means to plead guilty in a plea bargain after 8 years in torture chambers. He actually is a Canadian citizen, and Canada could extradite him, but they are courageously refusing to step on the toes of the master. The concept of terror and presumption of innocence is, you know, by now so far gone that nobody even bothers to discuss it. It's not, maybe it was once an ancient tradition, but not for us. And Glenn is quite right that the fact that it's been violated in the past doesn't change the fact that by now we've changed the principle. We've abandoned even the principle, not only abandoned it, but forcefully rejected it, even to the extent of saying the international order is established precisely to legitimate our violation of elementary legal and moral principles. Well, it goes beyond one of them. I'll give one last example. There was an article recently by a law professor who, in fact, Glenn cites a couple times in the book, Jonathan Turley, who argues that Obama may be breaking the record for a U.S. president for violation of civil rights and law. And you can make a case. One example, which actually involves the former dean of the Harvard Law School, is happens to be Obama's latest Supreme Court appointee, Elena Kagan. She argued a case brought by the Justice Department against a group called the Humanitarian Law Project, Holder v. Humanitarian Law Project, with the support of the far-right justices. Obama won that case. The charge is one that might implicate plenty of people here. The charge is they provided material assistance to a group that's on the terrorist list. The material assistance in this case was legal advice to the PKK, a group that's on the Turkish group, Kurdish groups on the U.S. terrorist list, which means they expanded the concept of material assistance from, say, you know, providing guns or something like that, to providing legal advice and even advice to turn to nonviolent means. That's now criminal under U.S. law, thanks to President Obama, and extends very broadly. In fact, shortly after this Supreme Court decision, dozens of FBI agents raided homes in Chicago and other cities, destroyed documents, the usual thing when a couple dozen FBI agents raid your home. The charge was they were trying to find evidence that the people they were finally indicted with a grand jury are supporting a Palestinian group and a Colombian group, PFLP and FARC. Well, maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But the idea that expressing support for groups on the terrorist list is a crime, is material assistance, that's novel. And the Justice Department position was explained by Kagan that if you provide legal advice to a terrorist group, say advising them to refrain from terror and pursue nonviolent means, you're legitimizing them and freeing up their resources to carry out terrorist acts. Well, just think how broadly that can apply, as in these cases, which are in fact underway. And a final comment, which has to do with the notion of the terrorist list. That's accepted in the United States as a legitimate category. Why is it a legitimate category? How is the terrorist list established? It's established by Executive Fayette. They don't have to give any justification for it. Those on the terrorist list can't say, I don't belong there. This is just a decision by the executive that I don't like you and we're going to prosecute. We're going to kill you and prosecute anyone now who advises you not to pursue terror. And you look back at the history of the terrorist list, it's very striking. I mean, one person who was just removed from it 2 years ago is Nelson Mandela. The reason is that the African National Congress was characterized by the Reagan administration in 1988, right near the end of apartheid, as one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. Therefore, the U.S. was entitled to support apartheid South Africa, as it did, not only in its atrocities internally, but in its attacks on neighboring countries, which apparently killed about 1.5 million people. But that's all okay. It's part of the war on terror that, in fact, Reagan had declared. And we have to defend the apartheid regime against one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world, including Nelson Mandela. By today's standards, Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project, almost anyone who was involved in anti-apartheid activity could be regarded as a terrorist giving material support for terrorism. And as I said, Mandela was just removed from the terrorist list 2 years ago. He can now come to the United States without special dispensation. Now, there are other equally dramatic cases. Take 1982. There was a state that had been on the terrorist list, Saddam Hussein's Iraq. But the Reagan administration wanted to provide aid and assistance to Saddam. So therefore, they removed Iraq from the terrorist list and proceeded to provide aid and assistance right through his worst crimes, denying the crimes. And in fact, rather strikingly, when Saddam was tried, it was for crimes that he committed in 1982, by his standards, pretty minor crimes, excluding the major crimes, I presume because those were all supported by the United States and, in fact, even denied by the Reagan administration. Well, there was a gap in the terrorist list because Iraq was removed, had to be filled. So it was filled by Cuba. Cuba was added to the terrorist list partly in order to give some justification for outlandish claims about why we were entitled to support murderous terrorist regimes in Central America, which left a couple hundred thousand corpses, much worse thanks to our involvement. And you had to, so the argument was, well, they're being supported by Cuba, so it must be a terrorist state fabrication, but that doesn't matter in these cases. However, Cuba was a pretty good choice. In the preceding years, Cuba had been the target of more international terrorism than probably the rest of the world combined, a lot of it coming from right here. So therefore, Cuba went into the terrorist list. and Saddam was taken off so we could support his major crimes, which were coming. We ought to think about why we even tolerate the concept of a terrorist list. And it's just not questioned. The government says someone's on a terrorist list, period, end of discussion. And now if you give, say, legal advice or other advice to somebody that they so designate, you're a criminal. And if you're a 15-year-old child who's allegedly picking up a gun to defend a village that's under attack by U.S. soldiers, you sent off for 16 years of prison torture and so on. That's what the rule of law has come to. It's a sad situation.
So I think we wanted, do we have a few minutes and to start before we get to the question and answer? I want to make sure to leave a substantial time. But unsurprisingly, what we just heard has provoked a lot of thoughts that I want to make, because I think so many interesting points were just raised. So one of the interesting aspects of this two-tier justice system and the idea that elites can impose standards on everyone else from which they exempt themselves, it's something that is obviously mirrored in the context of foreign relations, and I think probably was even pioneered there, this idea that the United States imposes standards on everybody else and exempts itself is really the template that then got imported domestically. And one of the fascinating things to do is to go and look at what current political leaders say about things like war crimes investigations and accountability when they're in other countries, doling out sermons and lectures about what those other countries should do. So, for example, President Obama, who promulgated and gifted us all with the slogan that we as good citizens should look forward and not backward in order to justify shielding Bush-era crimes from accountability, gave an interview last year on television in Indonesia, and the Obama administration has been pushing the Indonesian government to prosecute certain war criminals whom the United States has long disliked. And what he told the Indonesians was, it is impossible to move forward into a prosperous future until you've resolved the past. And Secretary of State Clinton has visited both Kenya and Cambodia, where the United States is similarly urging war crimes investigations to proceed, and has told them the same thing, essentially, that you cannot be among the nation, the community of decent nations, while you continue to harbor and shield war criminals from accountability. And I think the time that she visited Kenya and said that was the time that George Bush's book was released, and he was on every major television station being heralded as a great statesman. And of course, if you read, and I would really recommend that you do, I did this because I heard Professor Chomsky many years ago talk about it and went and read it, the opening and closing statements by Robert Jackson at the Nuremberg Tribunals. It's incredibly enlightening, because that was supposed to be the expression of modern justice. And not only did Jackson point out that aggressive war was the kingpin crime, the crime above all others, but he also said that the Nuremberg tribunals would have value only if they were applied not only to the defendants in the dock, but also to all the nations here assembled, meaning the United States and its allies. And yet, if you were to cite that and argue that that meant that George Bush and Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld should be prosecuted as war criminals for the aggressive attack on Iraq, there's almost nothing you could do that's more self-marginalizing than that. Even people sympathetic to the idea that they should be investigated criminally for the torture regime or for a warrantless eavesdropping somewhat recoil at the idea that they should be held criminally accountable for the at least 100,000 dead innocent Iraqis, I think, because they view the act of Congress authorizing it and the large majorities of the American citizenry cheering for it as something that ought to immunize them from that. And it, I think, shows just how lawless we've become, that you can't even cite the Nuremberg principles and argue for its applicability in the clearest possible case without becoming self-marginalized. Just a quick point about assassinations and the like. I certainly agree with Professor Chomsky that from a moral and ethical perspective, there's zero difference between sending a sky robot over another country and eradicating the lives of non-citizens, as opposed to doing that to citizens based upon mere suspicion or even a lack of suspicion, just as a desire to kill them. But I do think there's a practical difference. That is that there is a greater and enhanced danger on several levels when the government begins murdering its own citizens for political dissidents as opposed to citizens of other countries on foreign soil. And the difference is this. I think that, you know, just legalistically, the Supreme Court, for better or for worse, right or wrong, has said that the Constitution applies to foreigners on U.S. soil and to American citizens wherever they are found in the world. But more importantly than that is that when the government starts acting against its own citizens, it really can escalate a climate of fear that can lead to political suppression. And I think that's one of the things that you've really seen in the United States. One of the most striking experiences I've had since I began writing about politics was the first time that I ever wrote about WikiLeaks. This was back in early 2010. And this was before really almost nobody knew who WikiLeaks was at the time. This was before they had released any of their news-making disclosures inside the United States. They had released several important documents and had exposed wrongdoing among corporations and governments in other parts of the world, but not really in the United States. And nobody, including me, really knew much about them. But the Pentagon had prepared a top-secret report. They literally classified it top-secret in 2008. That declared WikiLeaks to be an enemy of the state, and it described ways that they could go about destroying WikiLeaks. And it's incredible because the way in which WikiLeaks has been rendered all but inoperable pretty much comports with the things the Pentagon laid out in this 2008 report. But in any event, in this 2008 report, this top secret report, ironically, was leaked to WikiLeaks, which then published it. And the New York Times wrote about it, and the New York Times article basically said there's the Pentagon report that's been leaked that declares WikiLeaks an enemy of the state and talks about ways to destroy it. And I didn't know very much at all about WikiLeaks at the time, but I kind of assumed that any organization that had been targeted that way by the Pentagon was one that merited a lot more attention and probably a lot more encouragement and even support. And so I went and read a lot about them, and I interviewed Julian Assange for the article that I wrote, and I wrote about it, and I posted the audio interview. And at the end, I encouraged people to go and donate to WikiLeaks because they had budgetary constraints that were preventing them from going public with a lot of these disclosures. It takes a lot of time and energy to authenticate the documents. One of the things the Pentagon talked about to destroy them was submitting fraudulent documents to them so that when they published it, it would forever destroy their credibility and the credibility of future disclosures. And in response to my recommendation that people go and donate to them, and I provided a link how people could do that electronically and online and through PayPal, dozens of people literally told me in many different venues, in the comment section to what I had written, by email, at events like this where I talked to people, that although they agreed wholeheartedly with what I had written about the potential of WikiLeaks to achieve great good, that they were afraid of donating money to WikiLeaks, especially electronically, because they would end up on some government list somewhere, or that they could even be subjected to criminal liability under the extraordinarily broad material support for terrorism statutes that Professor Chomsky just talked about. And these were not people prone to wild conspiracy theories. These were very sober Americans who I had interaction with in the past on other issues. A lot of them were. And I could just tell from the way that they were expressing these fears that they were very rational people. And these fears were well-grounded. And the reason it was so amazing to me was because it really highlighted how this extraordinary climate of fear has been created in the United States. WikiLeaks is a group that had never been, and still has never been, charged with a crime, let alone convicted of one. And they couldn't be, because what they're doing is pure First Amendment activity that the New York Times and the Washington Post, in theory, do every day, which is publicize leaks that are given to them by other people. And yet, these were American citizens who were petrified of exercising core First Amendment rights, which is what donating money to an organization whose political cause you support is. And they were basically intimidated from the things we've seen over the last 10 years in terms of lawlessness by what the government has done from exercising these rights. So you can offer all the rights in the world on a piece of paper or a piece of parchment that you want. You don't need to eliminate those rights if you can intimidate and bully the population into refraining from exercising them. And this really occurred to me even more when I wrote for the first time about the extremely harsh and oppressive conditions in which Bradley Manning was being detained. And I remember when I first wrote about it, a lot of people wondered, and I actually even wondered myself, why would the Obama administration basically turned Bradley Manning into almost a martyr and even jeopardized its own ability to prosecute him by subjecting him to this extremely severe, you could call it torture, but at the very least, it's inhumane treatment. He was in prolonged solitary confinement for 9 months despite being convicted of nothing. His clothes were taken from him. He was stripped nude and forced to stand naked for many of those days. Just completely punitive measures. And at some point shortly thereafter, I realized that the reason that that was done was the same reason that the Bush administration took people who were completely innocent by the hundreds and shipped them thousands of miles away to a Caribbean island and dressed them in orange jumpsuits and shackles and showed the world what we had done. It's a way of signaling to the world and to would-be challengers to American power, both domestically and internationally, that we are not constrained by law. We don't have any limits on what we can do. If you're somebody who thinks about challenging what we can do, take a look at these pictures of people at Guantanamo who are going to be there for as long as we want to keep them there, even if they're innocent. Or if you're somebody who discovers wrongdoing and serious illegality at the highest levels of our government and you want to expose it to the world, think about and look at what we've done to Bradley Manning or what we're now doing to WikiLeaks without any even pretense to legal authority and without any constraint whatsoever. It's really the use of law as a means of coercion, which is the exact antithesis of what it was supposed to be. It's those in power using law as a weapon to entrench their power and to shield their ill-gotten gains. And the fact that we can call terrorism whatever we want it to be, the fact that people who, as Professor Chomsky said, take up arms and fight against American troops are terrorists, the fact that we just indicted someone 9 months ago for, quote, raising funds to kill American troops in Iraq. This was an Iraqi who had raised money to defend his own homeland from an invading army. So if you're an Iraqi and the American army invades your country and you take up arms against them, you're a terrorist. Nidal Hassan, who attacked a military base of a country that has spent 10 years proclaiming we are at war and killed soldiers about to be deployed to war, he is a terrorist as well. And yet when the United States or Israel or our allies directly target and kill civilians by enormous numbers, whether recklessly or deliberately, it would be a radical act to describe that as terrorism. This is all designed to be able to criminalize whomever the United States wants, namely those who challenge it in any meaningful way. And that really is the use of law coercively to entrench those in power rather than to equalize the playing field. The final point I want to make, and then I think we can turn it over to questions and answers, is Professor Chomsky referenced this post by Matt Yglesias, who is a byproduct of this school near where we're talking. And he also works for the Center for American Progress, which is basically an organization run by John Podesta, the former Clinton White House official that was founded, in essence, to justify and defend whatever the Obama White House does. With some exceptions here and there if you search hard enough, but basically that's its function. And the fact that people who write for them do things and say things to mitigate or defend things like assassinating an American citizen with no due process, probably the most radical act that you can think of, really underscores an important point about the way the Obama legacy is being defined and the way that lawlessness has become normalized. So if, 3 years ago, and I know I say this as somebody who was doing it, if you were to go to an event like this and fill the room with 50% Republicans and 50% Democrats, and you were to talk about and condemn things like wild assertions of executive authority, the idea that the president can act against anyone he wants with no constraints whatsoever, including killing him, that he can do so in total secrecy and with no transparency or checks. And of course, after we killed Anwar al-Awlaki, 2 weeks later, a drone attack killed his 16-year-old son and his 17-year-old cousin in Yemen, and that the U.S. government refuses to even account for what it did there or describe what principles. If you were to talk about those things and the other radical secrecy doctrines the Bush administration used, you would have 50% of the room, the ones identified, self-identified as Republicans, supporting it, cheering for it, justifying it, apologizing for it, and being happy with it. But 50% of the room, the ones self-identified as Democrats, would be feigning anger over it. They'd be objecting to it as shredding the Constitution and right-wing radicalism and all of this. If you were to take that same exact group of people and put them in a room like this now and talk about those same exact things that I just described, you would now have 90% of the room cheering for it and supporting it, or at least justifying it and mitigating it the way Matt Yglesias in that post did, or at least acquiescing to it, and maybe 10% of the room continuing to be angry about it because they were actually angry about its being done the first time around and not pretending to be angry opportunistically for partisan gain. And this has really changed the way that these issues are discussed, the fact that now it's not just the Republican Party standing for this form of lawlessness, but that it's become, under President Obama, bipartisan consensus, which means it's removed from political debate, it is hardly controversial any longer, and it's entrenched as orthodoxy in American political life for at least a generation. There's Jack Balkin, who's a Yale law professor, has talked about how when one party objects to a policy and the other opposes it or supports it, what happens when the other party gets into office and starts continuing it, it becomes no longer a controversial policy. It becomes American consensus and endures without much challenge for at least a generation. That is what has happened to these policies of lawlessness and wild theories of executive power and the right of the American president to target anyone for violence or interrogation or incarceration without any oversight. It has now taken on the face of both parties and is therefore likely normalized for a very long time. And to me, that's one of the most significant legacies of the Obama presidency. So with that, I think it's a good time to take questions. I think the mechanics were described at the start. I didn't hear it, so I will rely on you to...
Well, first, thanks to our speakers. We have about 15, 20 minutes for questions, so just head down to this mic and try to keep your questions brief so we can get to as many as you as possible. Thanks.